expected a halfling to represent the city, and wondered why Cassius hadn't come personally to such an important meeting.
"Do you come before me as the official representative of Bryn Shander and all who now reside within her walls?"
Regis nodded.
"I am Regis of Lonelywood," he answered, "a friend to Cassius and former member of the Council of Ten. I have been appointed to speak for the people within the city."
Cassel's eyes narrowed in anticipation of his victory.
"And do you bear their message of unconditional surrender?"
Regis shuffled uneasily, purposely shifting so that the ruby pendant would start into motion on his chest.
"I desire private counsel with thee, mighty wizard, that we might discuss the terms of the agreement."
Cassel's eyes widened. He looked at Cassius upon the wall.
"I said unconditional!"
he shrieked. Behind him, the lights of Kryshal Tirith began to swirl and grow.
"Now you shall witness the folly of your insolence!"
"Wait!"
pleaded Regis, jumping around to regain the wizard's attention.
"There are some things that you should be aware of before all is decided."
Cassel paid little attention to the halfling's rambling, but the ruby pendant suddenly caught his attention. Even through the protection offered by the distance between his physical body and the window of his image projection, he found the gem fascinating. Regis couldn't resist the urge to smile, though only slightly, when he realized that the eyes of the wizard no longer blinked.
"I have some information that I am sure you will find valuable,"
the halfling said quietly. Cassel signaled for him to continue.
"Not here," Regis whispered. "There are too many curious ears about. Not all of the gathered goblins would be pleased to hear what I have to say."
Cassel considered the halfling's words for a moment. He felt curiously subdued for some reason that he couldn't yet understand.
"Very well, halfling," he agreed. "I shall hear your words."
With a flash and a puff of smoke, the wizard was gone. Regis looked back over his shoulder at the people on the wall and nodded. Under telepathic command from within the tower, the trolls shifted the mirrors to catch Regis's reflection. A second flash and puff of smoke, and Regis, too, was gone. On the wall, Cassius returned the halfling's nod, though Regis had already disappeared. The spokesman breathed a bit easier, comforted by the last look Regis had thrown him and by the fact that the sun was setting and Bryn Shander still stood. If his guess, based on the timing of the wizard's actions, was correct, Kryshal Tirith drew most of its energy from the light of the sun. It appeared that his plan had bought them at least one more night. Even through his bleary eyes, Drizzt recognized the dark shape that hovered over him. The drow had banged his head when he had been thrown from the scimitar's hilt, and Guinevere, his loyal companion, had kept a silent vigil throughout the long hours the drow had remained unconscious, even though the cat had also been battered in the fight with Ertu. Drizzt rolled into a sitting position and tried to reorient himself to his surroundings. At first he thought that dawn had come, but then he realized that the dim sunlight was coming from the west. He had been out for the better part of a day, drained completely, for the scimitar had sapped his vital energy in its battle with the demon. Guinevere looked even more haggard. The cat's shoulder hung limp from its collision with the stone wall, and Ertu had torn a deep cut into one of its forelegs. More than injuries, though, fatigue was wearing on the magical beast. It had overstayed the normal limits of its visit to the material plane by many hours. The cord between its home plane and the drow's was only kept intact by the cat's own magical energy, and each passing minute that it remained in this world drew away a bit of its strength. Drizzt stroked the muscled neck tenderly. He understood the sacrifice Guinevere had made for his sake, and he wished that he could comply with the cat's needs and send it back to its own world. But he could not. If the cat returned to its own plane, it would be hours before it would regain the strength required to re-establish a link back to this world, and he needed the cat now. "A bit longer," he begged. The faithful beast lay down beside him without any hint of protest. Drizzt looked upon it with pity, and petted the neck once again. How he longed to release the cat from his service, yet he could not. From what Ertu had told him, the door to Kreishal Tirith was invisible only to beings of the material plane. Drizzt needed the cat's eyes. 28. A lie within a lie. Regis rubbed the afterimage of the blinding flash out of his eyes and found himself again facing the wizard. Kessel lounged on a crystal throne, leaning back against one of its arms with his legs casually thrown over the other. They were in a squared room of crystal, giving a slick visual impression, but feeling as solid as stone. Regis knew immediately that he was inside the tower. The room was filled with dozens of ornate and strangely shaped mirrors. One of these in particular, the largest and most decorative, caught the halfling's eye, for a fire was ablaze within its depths. At first, Regis looked opposite the mirror, expecting to see the source of the image. But then he realized that the flames were not a reflection, but an actual event occurring within the dimensions of the mirror itself.
"Welcome to my home," the wizard laughed. "You should consider yourself fortunate to witness its splendor."
But Regis fixed his gaze upon Kessel, studying the wizard closely, for the tone of his voice did not resemble the characteristic slur of others he had entranced with the ruby.
"You'll forgive my surprise when first we met," Kessel continued. "I did not expect the sturdy men of Ten Towns to send a halfling to do their work."
He laughed again, and Regis knew that something had disrupted the charm he had cast upon the wizard when they were outside. The halfling could guess what had happened. He could feel the throbbing power of this room. It was evident that Kessel fed off of it. With his psyche outside, the wizard had been vulnerable to the magic of the gemstone, but in here, his strength was quite beyond the ruby's influence.
"You said that you had information to tell me," Kessel demanded suddenly. "Speak now, the whole of it, or I shall make your death an unpleasant one."
Regis stuttered, trying to improvise an alternative tale. The insidious lies he had planned to weave would have little value on the unaffected wizard. In fact, in their obvious weaknesses, they might reveal much of the truth about Cassius's strategies. Kessel straightened on his throne and leaned over the halfling, imposing his gaze upon his counterpart.
"Speak!"
he commanded evenly. Regis felt an iron will insinuating itself into all of his thoughts, compelling him to obey Kessel's every command. He sensed that the dominating force wasn't emanating from the wizard, though. Rather, it seemed to be coming from some external source, perhaps the unseen object that the wizard occasionally clutched in a pocket of his robes. Those of halfling stock possessed a strong natural resistance to such magic, however, and a countering force, the gemstone, helped Regis fight back against the insinuating will and gradually push it away. A sudden idea came over Regis. He had certainly seen enough individuals fall under his own charms to be able to imitate their revealing posture. He slouched a bit, as though he had suddenly been put completely at ease, and focused his blank stare on an image in the corner of the room beyond Kessel's shoulder. He felt his eyes drying out, but he resisted the temptation to blink.
"What information do you desire?"
he responded mechanically. Kessel slumped back again confidently.
"Address me as Master Kessel," he ordered.
"What information do you desire, Master Kessel?"
"Good," the wizard smirked to himself. "Admit the truth, halfling. The story you were sent to tell me was a deception."
Why not, Regis thought. A lie flavored with the sprinklings of truth becomes that much stronger.
"Yes,"
he answered.
"To make you think that your truest allies plotted against you."
"And what was the purpose?"
Kessel pressed, quite pleased with himself.
"Surely the people of Bryn Shander know that I could easily crush them, even without any allies at all. It seems a feeble plan to me."
"Cassius had no intentions of trying to defeat you, Master Kessel,"
Regis said.
"Then why are you here? And why didn't Cassius simply surrender the city as I demanded?"
I was sent to plant some doubts,
replied Regis, blindly improvising to keep Kessel intrigued and occupied. Behind the facade of his words, he was trying to put together some kind of an alternate plan.
To give Cassius more time to lay out his true course of action.
Kessel leaned forward.
And what might that course of action be?
Regis paused, searching for an answer.
You cannot resist me!
Kessel roared.
My will is too great. Answer, or I shall tear the truth from your mind.
To escape,
Regis blurted. And after he had said it, several possibilities opened up before him. Kessel reclined again.
Impossible, he replied casually. My army is too strong at every point for the humans to break through.
Perhaps not as strong as you believe, Master Kessel, Regis baited.
His path now lay clear before him. A lie within another lie. He liked the formula.
Explain,
Kessel demanded, a shadow of worry clouding his cocky visage.
Cassius has allies within your ranks.
The wizard leaped from his chair, trembling in rage. Regis marveled at how effectively his simple imitation was working. He wondered for an instant if any of his own victims had likewise reversed the dupe on him. He put the disturbing thought away for future contemplation.
Orcs have lived among the people of Ten Towns for many months now, Regis went on. One tribe actually opened up a trading relationship with the fishermen. They too answered your summons to arms, but they still hold loyalties, if any of their kind ever truly hold loyalties, to Cassius. Even as your army was entrenching in the field around Bryn Shander, the first communications were exchanged between the orc chieftain and orc messengers that slipped out of Bryn Shander.
Kessel smoothed his hair back and rubbed his hand nervously across his face. Was it possible that his seemingly invincible army had a secret weakness? No, none would dare oppose Akkar Kessel. But still, if some of them were plotting against him, if all of them were plotting against him, would he know? And where was Ertu? Could the demon be behind this?
Which tribe?
He asked Regis softly, his tone revealing that the halfling's news had humbled him. Regis drew the wizard fully into the deception.
The group that you sent to sack the city of Bremen, the orcs of the Severed Tongue, he said,
watching the wizard's widening eyes with complete satisfaction.
My job was merely to prevent you from taking any action against Bryn Shander before the fall of night, for the orcs shall return before dawn, presumably to regroup in their assigned position on the field, but in actuality to open a gap in your western flank. Cassius will lead the people down the western slope to the open tundra. They only hope to keep you disorganized long enough to give them a solid lead. Then you shall be forced to pursue them all the way to Luskan.
Many weak points were apparent in the plan, but it seemed a reasonable gamble for people in such a desperate situation to attempt. Kessel slammed his fist down on the arm of the throne.
The fools! He growled.
Regis breathed a bit easier. Kessel was convinced.
Ertu!
He screamed suddenly, unaware that the demon had been banished from the world. There was no reply.
Oh, damn you, demon!
Kessel cursed.
You are never about when I need you most!
He spun on Regis.
You wait here. I shall have many more questions for you later.
The roaring fires of his anger simmered wickedly.
But first, I must speak with some of my generals. I shall teach the orcs of the Severed Tongue to oppose me!
In truth, the observations Cassius had made had labeled the orcs of the Severed Tongue as Kessel's strongest and most fanatical supporters. A lie within a lie. Out on the waters of Mare de Walden later that evening, the assembled fleet of the four towns watched suspiciously as a second group of monsters flowed out from the main force and headed in the direction of Bremen.
Curious!
Kemp remarked to Muldoon of Lonelywood and the spokesman from the burned city of Bremen, who were standing on the deck of Targos's flagship beside him. All of Bremen's populace was out on the lake. Certainly, the first group of orcs, after the initial bow shots, had met no further resistance in the city. And Bryn Shander stood intact. Why, then, was the wizard further extending his line of power?
"Akkar Kessel confuses me," said Muldoon. "Either his genius is simply beyond me, or he truly makes glaring tactical errors." "Assume the second possibility," Kemp instructed hopefully. "For anything that we might try shall be in vain if the first is the truth."
So they continued repositioning their warriors for an opportune strike, moving their children and women folk in the remaining boats to the as yet unassigned moorings of Lonelywood, similar to the strategies of the refugee forces on the other two lakes. On the wall of Bryn Shander, Cassius and Glensather watched the division of Kessel's forces with deeper understanding. "Masterfully done, halfling," Cassius whispered into the night wind. Smiling, Glensather put a steadying hand on his fellow spokesman's shoulder. "I shall go and inform our field commanders," he said. "If the time for us to attack comes, we shall be ready." Cassius clasped Glensather's hand and nodded his approval. As the spokesman from Easthaven sped away, Cassius leaned upon the ridge of the wall, glaring determinedly at the now darkened walls of Kryshal Tirith. Through gritted teeth he declared openly, "The time shall come!" From the high vantage point of Kelvin's cairn, Drizzt Do'Urden had also witnessed the abrupt shift of the monster army. He had just completed the final preparations for his courageous assault on Kryshal Tirith when the distant flickers of a large mass of torches suddenly flowed away to the west. He and Guinevar sat quietly and studied the situation for a short while, trying to find some clue as to what had prompted such action. Nothing became apparent, but the night was growing long and he had to make haste. He wasn't sure if the activity would prove helpful, by thinning out the camp's ranks, or disruptive, by heightening the remaining monster's state of readiness. Yet he knew that the people of Bryn Shander could not afford any delays. He started down the mountain trail, the great panther trailing along silently behind him. He made the open ground in good time and started his hasty trot down the length of Bremen's Run. If he had paused to study his surroundings, or put one of his sensitive ears to the ground, he might have heard the distant rumble from the open tundra to the north of yet another approaching army. But the drow's focus was on the south, his vision narrowed upon the waiting darkness of Kryshal Tirith as he made haste. He was traveling light, carrying only items he believed essential to the task. He had his five weapons, the two scimitars sheathed in their leather scabbards on his hips, a dagger tucked in his belt at the middle of his back, and the two knives hidden in his boots. His holy symbol and pouch of wealth was around his neck, and a small sack of flour, left over from the raid on the giant's lair, still hung on his belt. A sentimental choice, a comforting reminder of the daring adventures he had shared with Wulfgar. All of his other supplies, backpack, rope, water skins, and other basic items of everyday survival on the harsh tundra, he had left in the small cubby. He heard the shouts of goblin merrymaking when he crossed by the eastern outskirts of Tourmaline. "Strike now, sailors of Mare de Walden," the drow said quietly. But when he thought about it, he was glad that the boats remained out on the lake. Even if they could slip in and strike quickly at the monsters in the city, they could not afford the losses they would suffer. Tourmaline could wait. There was a more important battle yet to be fought. Drizzt and Guinevar approached the outer perimeter of Kessel's main encampment. The drow was comforted by signs that the commotion within the camp had quieted. A solitary orc guard leaned wearily on its spear, half-heartedly watching the empty blackness of the northern horizon. Even had it been wary, it would not have noticed the stealthy approach of the two shapes, blacker than the darkness of night.
"Call in!" came a command from somewhere in the distance. "Clear!" replied the guard.
Drizzt listened as the check was called in from various distant spots. He signaled for Guinevar to hold back, then crept up within throwing range of the guard. The tired orc never even heard the whistle of the approaching dagger. And then Drizzt was beside it, silently breaking its fall into the darkness. The drow pulled his dagger from the orc's throat and laid his victim softly on the ground. He and Gwenivar, unnoticed shadows of death, moved on. They had broken through the only line of guards that had been set on the northern perimeter, and now easily picked their way among the sleeping camp. Drizzt could have killed dozens of orcs and goblins, even a Verbeeg, though the cessation of its thundering snores might have drawn attention. But he couldn't afford to slow his pace. Each passing minute continued to drain Gwenivar, and now the first hints of a second enemy, the revealing dawn, were becoming apparent in the eastern sky. The drow's hopes had risen considerably with the progress he had made, but he was dismayed when he came upon Kryshal Tirith. A group of battle-ready ogre guards ringed the tower, blocking his way. He crouched beside the cat, undecided on what they should do. To escape the breadth of the huge camp before the dawn exposed them, they would have to flee back the way they came. Drizzt doubted that Gwenivar, in its pitiful state, could even attempt that route. Yet to go on meant a hopeless fight with a group of ogres. There seemed no answer to the dilemma. Then something happened back in the northeast section of the encampment, opening a path for the stealthy companions. Sudden shouts of alarm sprang up, drawing the ogres a few long strides away from their posts. Drizzt thought at first that the murdered orc guard had been discovered, but the cries were too far to the east. Soon the clang of steel on steel rang out in the pre-dawn air. A battle had been joined. Rival tribes, Drizzt supposed, though he could not spot the combatants from the distance. His curiosity wasn't overwhelming, however. The undisciplined ogres had moved even farther away from their appointed positions, and Gwenivar had spotted the tower door. The two didn't hesitate for a second. The ogres never even noticed the two shadows enter the tower behind them. A strange sensation, a buzzing vibration, came over Drizzt as he passed through Kryshal Tirith's entryway, as though he had moved into the bowels of a living entity. He continued on, though, through the darkened hallway that led to the tower's first level, marveling at the strange crystalline material that comprised the walls and floors of the structure. He found himself in a squared hall, the bottom chamber of the four-roomed structure. This was the hall where Kessel often met with his field generals, the wizard's primary audience hall for all but his top-ranking commanders. Drizzt peered around at the dark forms in the room and the deeper shadows that they created. Though he sighted no movement, he sensed that he was not alone. He knew that Gwenivar had the same uneasy feelings, for the fur on the scruff of the black-coated neck was ruffled, and the cat let out a low growl. Kessel considered this room a buffer zone between himself and the rabble of the outside world. It was the one chamber in the tower that he rarely visited. This was the place where Akar Kessel housed his trolls. 29. Other Options. The dwarves of Mithril Hall completed the first of their secret exits shortly after sunset. Brunner was the first to climb to the top of the ladder and peek out from under the cut sod at the settling monster army. So expert were the dwarven miners that they had been able to dig a shaft right up into the middle of a large group of goblins and ogres without even alerting the monsters in the least. Brunner was smiling when he came back down to rejoin his clansmen. "Finish the other nine," he instructed, as he moved down the tunnel, Catty Bree beside him. "Tonight's sleep will be a sound one for some of Kessel's boys," he declared, patting the head of his belted axe.
"What role am I to play in the coming battle?" Catty Bree asked when they moved away from the other dwarves.
"You'll get to pull one of the levers and collapse the tunnels if any of the swine come down," Brunner replied.
"And if you are all killed on the field," Catty Bree reasoned, "being buried alone in these tunnels does not hold much promise for me."
Brunner stroked his red beard. He hadn't considered that consequence, figuring only that if he and his clan were cut down on the field, Catty Bree would be safe enough behind the collapsed tunnels. But how could she live down here alone? What price would she pay for survival?
"Do you want to come up and fight, then? You're fair enough with a sword, and I'll be right beside ye."
Catty Bree considered the proposition for a moment.
I'll stay with the lever, she decided. You'll have enough to look after your own head up there. And someone has to be down here to drop the tunnels. We cannot let goblins claim our halls as their home. Besides, she added with a smile, it was stupid of me to worry. I know that you will come back to me, Brunner. Never have you, nor any of your clan, failed me.
She kissed the dwarf on the forehead and skipped away. Brunner smiled after her.
Sure, and you're a brave girl, my Catibri, he muttered.
The work on the tunnels was finished a few hours later. The shafts had been dug, and the entire tunnel complex around them had been rigged to collapse to cover any retreating action or squash any goblin advance. The entire clan, their faces purposely blackened with soot and their heavy armor and weapons muffled under layers of dark cloth, lined up at the base of the 10 shafts. Brunner went up first to investigate. He peeked out and smiled grimly. All around him, ogres and goblins had bedded down for the night. He was about to give the signal for his kinsmen to move when a commotion suddenly started up in the camp. Brunner remained at the top of the shaft, though he kept his head beneath the sod layer, which got him stepped on by a passing goblin, and tried to figure out what had alerted the monsters. He heard shouts of command and a clatter like a large force assembling. More shouts followed, calls for the death of the severed tongue. Though he had never heard that name before, the dwarf easily guessed that it described an orc tribe. So they're fighting amongst themselves, are they? He muttered softly, chuckling. Realizing that the dwarf's assault would have to wait, he climbed back down the ladder. But the clan, disappointed in the delay, did not disperse. They were determined that this night's work would indeed be done. So they waited. The night passed its midpoint, and still the sounds of movement came from the camp above, yet the wait wasn't dulling the edge of the dwarves' determination. Conversely, the delay was sharpening their intensity, heightening their hunger for goblin blood. These fighters were also blacksmiths, craftsmen, who spent long hours adding a single scale to a dragon statue. They knew patience. Finally, when all was quiet again, Brunner went back up the ladder. Before he had even poked his head through the turf, he heard the comforting sounds of rhythmic breathing and loud snores. Without further delay, the clan slipped out of the holes and methodically set about their murderous work. They did not revel in their roles as assassins, preferring to fight sword against sword, but they understood the necessity of this type of raid, and they placed no value whatsoever on the lives of goblin scum. The area gradually quieted as more and more of the monsters entered the silent sleep of death. The dwarves concentrated on the ogres first, in case their attack was discovered before they were able to do much damage. But their strategy was unnecessary. Many minutes passed without retaliation. By the time one of the guards noticed what was happening and managed to shout out a cry of alarm, the blood of more than 1,000 of Kessel's charges wetted the field. Cries went up all around them, but Brunner did not call for a retreat.
Form up, he commanded. Tight around the tunnels!
He knew that the mad rush of the first wave of counterattackers would be disorganized and unprepared. The dwarves formed into a tight defensive posture and had little trouble cutting the goblins down. Brunner's axe was marked with many more notches before any goblin had even taken a swing at him. Gradually, though, Kessel's charges became more organized. They came at the dwarves in formations of their own, and their growing numbers, as more and more of the camp was roused and alerted, began to press heavily on the raiders. And then a group of ogres, Kessel's elite tower guard, came charging across the field. The first of the dwarves to retreat, the tunnel experts, who were to make the final check on the preparations for the collapse, put their booted feet on the top rungs of the shaft ladders. The escape into the tunnels would be a delicate operation, and efficient haste would be the deciding factor in its success or failure. But Brunner unexpectedly ordered the tunnel experts to come back out of the shafts and the dwarves to hold their line. He had heard the first notes of an ancient song, a song that, just a few years before, would have filled him with dread. Now, though, it lifted his heart with hope. He recognized the voice that led the stirring words. A severed arm of rotted flesh splatted on the floor, yet another victim of the whirling scimitars of Drizzt O'Urden. But the fearless trolls crowded in. Normally, Drizzt would have known of their presence as soon as he entered the square chamber, Their terrible stench made it hard for them to hide. These ones, though, hadn't actually been in the chamber when the drow entered. As Drizzt had moved deeper into the room, he tripped a magical alarm that bathed the area in wizard's light and cued the guardians. They stepped in through the magical mirrors that Kessel had planted as watchposts throughout the room. Drizzt had already dropped one of the wretched beasts, but now he was more concerned with running than fighting. Five others replaced the first and were more than a match for any fighter. Drizzt shook his head in disbelief when the body of the troll he had beheaded suddenly rose again and began flailing blindly. And then a clawed hand caught hold of his ankle. He knew without looking that it was the limb he had just cut free. Horrified, he kicked the grotesque arm away from him and turned and sprinted to the spiraling stairway that ran up to the tower's second level from the back of the chamber. At his earlier command, Guinevere had already limped weakly up the stairs and now waited on the platform at the top. Drizzt distinctly heard the sucking footsteps of his sickening pursuers and the scratching of the severed hand's filthy nails as it also took up the chase. The drow bounded up the stairway without looking back, hoping that his speed and agility would give him enough of a lead to find some way of escaping. For there was no door on the platform. The landing at the top of the stairs was rectangular and about 10 feet across at its widest length. Two sides were open to the room, a third caught the lip of the cresting stairwell, and the fourth was a flat sheet of mirror, extending the exact length of the platform and secured between it and the chamber's ceiling. Drizzt hoped that he would be able to understand the nuances of this unusual door, if that was what the mirror actually was, when he examined it from the platform's level. It wouldn't be that easy. Though the mirror was filled with the reflection of an ornate tapestry hanging on the wall of the chamber directly opposite it, its surface appeared perfectly smooth and unbroken by any cracks or handles that might indicate a concealed opening. Drizzt sheathed his weapons and ran his hands across the surface to see if there was a handle hidden from his sharp eyes, but the even glide of the glass only confirmed his observation. The trolls were on the stairway. Drizzt tried to push his way through the glass, speaking all of the command words of opening he had ever learned, searching for an extra-dimensional portal similar to the ones that had held Kessel's hideous guards. The wall remained a tangible barrier. The lead troll reached the halfway point on the stairs.
"There must be a clue somewhere," the drow groaned. "Wizards love a challenge, and there is no sport to this."
The only possible answer lay in the intricate designs and images of the tapestry. Drizzt stared at it, trying to sort through the thousands of interwoven images for some special hint that would show him the way to safety. The stench flowed up to him. He could hear the slobbering of the ever-hungry monsters. But he had to control his revulsion and concentrate on the myriad images. One thing in the tapestry caught his eye, the lines of a poem that wove through all of the other images along the top border. In contrast to the dulling colors of the rest of the ancient artwork, the calligraphed letters of the poem held the contrasting brightness of a newer addition, something Kessel had added. "Come, if ye will, to the orgy within, but first ye must find the latch. Seen and not seen, been yet not been, and a handle that flesh cannot catch." One line in particular stood out in the drow's mind. He had heard the phrase, "been yet not been," in his childhood days in Menzo Berenzon. They referred to Urgutha Forca, a vicious demon that had ravaged the planet with a particularly virulent plague in the ancient times when Drizzt's ancestors had walked on the surface. The surface elves had always denied the existence of Urgutha Forca, blaming the plague on the drow, but the dark elves knew better. Something in their physical makeup had kept them immune to the demon, and after they realized how deadly it was to their enemies, they had worked to fulfill the suspicions of the Light Elves by enlisting Urgutha as an ally. Thus the reference, "been yet not been," was a derogatory line in a longer drow tale, a secret joke on their hated cousins, who had lost thousands to a creature they denied even existed. The riddle would have been impossible to anyone unaware of the tale of Urgutha Forca. The drow had found a valuable advantage. He scanned the reflection of the tapestry for some image that had a connection to the demon, and he found it on the far edge of the mirror at belt height, a portrayal of Urgutha itself, revealed in all of its horrible splendor. The demon was depicted smashing the skull of an elf with a black rod, its symbol. Drizzt had seen this same portrayal before. Nothing seemed out of place or hinted at anything unusual. The trolls had turned the final corner of their ascent. Drizzt was nearly out of time. He turned and searched the source of the image for some discrepancy. It struck him at once. In the original tapestry, Urgutha was striking the elf with his fist. There was no rod. Seen and not seen. Drizzt spun back on the mirror, grasping at the demon's illusory weapon. But all he felt was smooth glass. He nearly cried out in frustration. His experience had taught him discipline, and he quickly regained his composure. He moved his hand back away from the mirror, attempting to position his own reflection at the same depth he judged the rod to be at. He slowly closed his fingers, watching his hand's image close around the rod with the excitement of anticipated success. He shifted his hand slightly. A thin crack appeared in the mirror. The leading troll reached the top of the stairs, but Drizzt and Guinevere were gone. The drow slid the strange door back into its closed position, leaned back, and sighed with relief. A dimly lit stairway led up before him, ending with a platform that opened into the tower's second level. No door blocked the way, just hanging strands of beads, sparkling orange in the torchlight of the room beyond. Drizzt heard giggling. Silently, he and the cat crept up the stairs and peeked over the rim of the landing. They had come to Kessel's harem room. It was softly lit with torches glowing under screening shades. Most of the floor was covered with overstuffed pillows, and sections of the room were curtained off. The harem girls, Kessel's mindless playthings, sat in a circle in the center of the floor, giggling with the uninhibited enthusiasm of children at play. Drizzt doubted that they would notice him, but even if they did, he wasn't overly concerned. He understood right away that these pitiful, broken creatures were incapable of initiating any action against him. He kept alert, though, especially of the curtained boudoirs. He doubted that Kessel would have put guards here, certainly none as unpredictably vicious as trolls, but he couldn't afford to make any mistakes. With Guinevere close at his side, he slipped silently from shadow to shadow. And when the two companions had ascended the stairs and were on the landing before the door to the third level, Drizzt was more relaxed. But then the buzzing sound that Drizzt had heard when he first entered the tower returned. It gathered strength as it continued, as though its song came from the vibrations of the very walls of the tower. Drizzt looked all around for a possible source. Chimes hanging from the room's ceiling began to tinkle eerily. The fires of the torches on the walls danced wildly. Then Drizzt understood. The structure was awakening with a life of its own. The field outside remained under the shadow of night, but the first fingers of dawn brightened the tower's high pinnacle. The door suddenly swung open into the third level, Kessel's throne room.
"Well done!" cried the wizard.
He was standing beyond the crystalline throne across the room from Drizzt, holding an unlit candle and facing the open door. Regis stood obediently at his side, wearing a blank expression on his face.
"Please enter,"
Kessel said with false courtesy.
"Fear not for my trolls that you injured. They will surely heal."
He threw his head back and laughed. Drizzt felt a fool. To think that all of his caution and stealth had served no better purpose than to amuse the wizard. He rested his hands on the hilts of his sheathed scimitars and stepped through the doorway. Guinevere remained crouched in the shadows of the stairway, partly because the wizard had said nothing to indicate that he knew of the cat, and partly because the weakened cat didn't want to expend the energy of walking. Drizzt halted before the throne and bowed low. The sight of Regis standing beside the wizard disturbed him more than a little, but he managed to hide that he recognized the halfling. Regis likewise had shown no familiarity when he had first seen the drow, though Drizzt couldn't be sure if that was a conscious effort or if the halfling was under the influence of some type of enchantment.
"Greetings, Akar Kessel,"
Drizzt stammered, in the broken accents of denizens of the underworld, as though the common tongue of the surface was foreign to him. He figured that he might as well try the same tactics he had used against the demon.
"I am sent from my people in good faith to parley with you on matters concerning our common interests."
Kessel laughed aloud.
"Are you indeed?"
A wide smile spread across his face, replaced abruptly with a scowl. His eyes narrowed evilly.
I know you, Dark Elf. Any man who has ever lived in 10 towns has heard the name of Drizzt O'Urden in tale or in jest, so keep your lies unspoken.
Your pardon, mighty wizard, Drizzt said calmly, changing tactics. In many ways, it seems, you are wiser than your demon. The self-assured look disappeared from Kessel's face. He had been wondering what had prevented Ertu from answering his summons. He looked at the drow with more respect. Had this solitary warrior slain a major demon? Allow me to begin again, Drizzt said. Greetings, Akar Kessel. He bowed low. I am Drizzt O'Urden, ranger of Gueron Windstrom, guardian of Icewind Dale. I have come to kill you. The scimitars leaped out of their sheaths. But Kessel moved too. The candle he held suddenly flickered to life. Its flame was caught in the maze of prisms and mirrors that cluttered the entire chamber, focused and sharpened at each reflecting spot. Instantaneously, with the lighting of the candle, 3 concentrated beams of light enclosed the drow in a triangular prison. None of the beams had touched him, but he sensed their power and dared not cross their path. Drizzt clearly heard the tower humming as daylight filtered down its length. The room brightened considerably as several of the wall panels which had appeared mirror-like in the torchlight showed themselves to be windows.
Did you believe that you could walk right in here and simply dispose of me?
Kessel asked incredulously.
I am Akar Kessel, you fool, the tyrant of Icewind Dale. I command the greatest army that has ever marched on the frozen steppes of this forsaken land. Behold my army!
He waved his hand, and one of the scrying mirrors came to life, revealing part of the vast encampment that surrounded the tower, complete with the shouts of the awakening camp. Then a death cry sounded from somewhere in the unseen reaches of the field. Instinctively, both the drow and the wizard tuned their ears on a distant clamor and heard the continuing ring of battle. Drizzt looked curiously at Kessel, wondering if the wizard knew what was happening in the northern section of his camp. Kessel answered the drow's unspoken question with a wave of his hand. The image in the mirror clouded over with an inner fog for a moment, then shifted to the other side of the field. The shouts and clanging of the battle rang out loudly from within the depths of the scrying instrument. Then, as the mist cleared, the image of Brunner's clansmen fighting back to back in the midst of a sea of goblins came clear. The field all around the dwarves was littered with the corpses of goblins and ogres.
You see how foolish it is to oppose me?
Kessel squealed.
It appears to me that the dwarves have done well.
Nonsense!
Kessel screamed. He waved his hand again, and the fog returned to the mirror. Abruptly, the song of Tempest resounded from within its depths. Drizzt leaned forward and strained to catch a glimpse of an image through the veil, anxious to see the leader of the song.
Even as the stupid dwarves cut down a few of my lesser fighters, more warriors swarm to join the ranks of my army. Doom is upon you all, Drizzt O'Urden. Akar Kessel is come.
The fog cleared. With 1,000 fervent warriors behind him, Wulfgar approached the unsuspecting monsters. The goblins and orcs, who were closest to the charging barbarians, holding unbending faith in the words of their master, cheered at the coming of their promised allies. Then they died. The barbarian horde drove through their ranks, singing and killing with wild abandonment. Even through the clatter of weapons, the sound of the dwarves joining in the song of Tempest could be heard. Wide-eyed, jaw hanging open, trembling with rage, Kessel waved the shocking image away and swung back on Drizzt.
It does not matter,
he said, fighting to keep his tone steady.
I shall deal with them mercilessly, and then Bryn Shander shall topple in flames. But first you, traitorous drow,
the wizard hissed.
Killer of your own kin, what gods have you left to pray to?
He puffed on the candle, causing its flame to dance on its side. The angle of reflection shifted, and one of the beams landed on Drizzt, boring a hole completely through the hilt of his old scimitar, and then drove deeper, cutting through the black skin of his hand. Drizzt grimaced in agony and clutched to his wound as the scimitar fell to the floor and the beam returned to its original path.
You see how easy it is?
Kessel taunted.
Your feeble mind cannot begin to imagine the power of Crenshinabon. Feel blessed that I allowed you to feel a sample of that power before you died.
Drizzt held his jaw firm, and there was no sign of pleading in his eyes as he glared at the wizard. He had long ago accepted the possibility of death as an acceptable risk of his trade, and he was determined to die with dignity. Kessel tried to goad the sweat out of him. The wizard swayed the deadly candle tantalizingly about, causing the rays to shift back and forth. When he finally realized that he would not hear any whimpering or begging out of the proud ranger, Kessel grew tired of the game.
"Farewell, fool," he growled, and puckered his lips to puff on the flame.
Regis blew the candle out. Everything seemed to come to a complete halt for several seconds. The wizard looked down at the halfling, whom he thought to be his slave, in horrified amazement. Regis merely shrugged his shoulders, as if he was as surprised by his uncharacteristically brave act as Kessel. Relying on instinct, the wizard threw the silver plate that held the candle through the glass of the mirror and ran screaming toward the back corner of the room to a small ladder hidden in the shadows. Drizzt had just taken his first steps when the fires within the mirror roared. Four evil red eyes stared out, catching the drow's attention, and two hellhounds bounded through the broken glass. Guinevere intercepted one, leaping past its master and crashing headlong into the demon hound. The two beasts tumbled back toward the rear of the room, a black and tawny red blur of fangs and claws, knocking Regis aside. The second dog unleashed its fire breath at Drizzt, but again, as with the demon, the fire didn't bother the drow. Then it was his turn to strike. The fire-hating scimitar rang in ecstasy, cleaving the charging beast in half as Drizzt brought it down. Amazed at the power of the blade, but not having time even to gawk at his mutilated victim, Drizzt resumed his chase. He reached the bottom of the ladder. Up above, through the open trap door to the tower's highest floor, came the rhythmic flashing of a throbbing light. Drizzt felt the intensity of the vibrations increasing with each pulse. The heart of Kryshal Tirith was beating stronger with the rising sun. Drizzt understood the danger that he was heading into, but he didn't have time to stop and ponder the odds. And then he was once again facing Kessel, this time in the smallest room of the structure. Between them, hanging eerily in midair, was the pulsating hunk of crystal, Kryshal Tirith's heart. It was four-sided and tapered like an icicle. Drizzt recognized it as a miniature replica of the tower he stood in, though it was barely a foot long. An exact image of Crenshinabon. A wall of light emanated from it, cutting the chamber in half, with the drow on one side and the wizard on the other. Drizzt knew from the wizard's snicker that it was a barrier as tangible as one of stone. Unlike the cluttered scrying room below, only one mirror, appearing more like a window in the tower's wall, adorned this room just to the side of the wizard.
"Strike the heart, drow," Kessel laughed. "Fool, the heart of Kryshal Tirith is mightier than any weapon in the world. Nothing that you could ever do, magical or otherwise, could even put the slightest scratch upon its pure surface. Strike it! Let your foolish impertinence be revealed!"
Drizzt had other plans, though. He was flexible and cunning enough to realize that some foes could not be defeated with force alone. There were always other options. He sheathed his remaining weapon, the magical scimitar, and began untying the rope that secured the sack to his belt. Kessel looked on curiously, disturbed by the drow's calm, even when his death seemed inevitable.
"What are you doing?"
the wizard demanded. Drizzt didn't reply. His actions were methodical and unshaken. He loosened a drawstring on the sack and pulled it open.
"I asked what you were doing!"
Kessel scowled as Drizzt began walking toward the heart. Suddenly, the replica seemed vulnerable to the wizard. He had the uncomfortable feeling that perhaps this dark elf was more dangerous than he had originally estimated. Crenshinabon sensed it too. The crystal shard telepathically instructed Kessel to unleash a killing bolt and be done with the drow. But Kessel was afraid. Drizzt neared the crystal. He tried to put his hand over it, but the light wall repulsed him. He nodded, expecting as much, and pulled back the sack's opening as wide as it would go. His concentration was solely on the tower itself. He never looked at the wizard or acknowledged his ranting. Then he emptied the bag of flour over the gemstone.
The tower seemed to groan in protest. It darkened. The wall of light that separated the drow from the wizard disappeared, but still Drizzt concentrated on the tower. He knew that the layer of suffocating flower could only block the gemstone's powerful radiations for a short time. Long enough, though, for him to slip the now empty bag over it and pull the drawstring tight. Kessel wailed and lurched forward, but halted before the drawn scimitar.
"No!" the wizard cried in helpless protest. "Do you realize the consequences of what you have done?"
As if in answer, the tower trembled. It calmed quickly, but both the drow and the wizard sensed the approaching danger. Somewhere in the bowels of Kryshal Tirith, the decay had already begun.
"I understand completely," replied Drizzt. "I have defeated you, Akkar Kessel. Your short reign as self-proclaimed ruler of 10 towns is ended."
"You have killed yourself, drow!"
Kessel retorted, as Kryshal Tira shuddered again, this time even more violently.
"You cannot hope to escape before the tower crumbles upon you!"
The quake came again and again. Drizzt shrugged, unconcerned. "So be it," he said. "My purpose is fulfilled, for you too shall perish." A sudden crazy cackle exploded from the wizard's lips. He spun away from Drizzt and dived at the mirror embedded in the tower wall. Instead of crashing through the glass and falling to the field below as Drizzt expected, Kessel slipped into the mirror and was gone. The tower shook again, and this time the trembling did not relent. Drizzt started for the trapdoor, but could barely keep his footing. Cracks appeared along the walls.
"Regis!" he yelled, but there was no answer.
Part of the wall in the room below had already collapsed. Drizzt could see the rubble at the base of the ladder. Praying that his friends had already escaped, he took the only route left open to him. He dived through the magic mirror after Kessel. 30. The Battle of Icewind Dale. The people of Bryn Shander heard the fighting out on the field, but it wasn't until the lightning of full dawn that they could see what was happening. They cheered the dwarves wildly and were amazed when the barbarians crashed into Kessel's ranks, hacking down goblins with gleeful abandon. Cassius and Glenn Sather, in their customary positions upon the wall, pondered the unexpected turn of events, undecided as to whether or not they should release their forces into the fray.
"Barbarians?" gawked Glenn Sather. "Are they our friends or foes?"
"They kill orcs," Cassius answered. "They are friends."
Out on Mare de Walden, Kemp and the others also heard the clang of battle, though they couldn't see who was involved. Even more confusing, a second fight had begun, this one to the southwest in the town of Bremen. Had the men of Bryn Shander come out and attacked, or was Akkar Kessel's force destroying itself around him? Then Kryshal Tirith suddenly fell dark, its once glassy and vibrant sides taking on an opaque, deathly stillness.
"Regis," muttered Cassius, sensing the tower's loss of power. "If ever a hero we had."
The tower shuddered and shook. Great cracks appeared over the length of its walls. Then it broke apart. The monster army looked on in horrified disbelief as the bastion of the wizard they had come to worship as a god came crashing down. The horns in Bryn Shander began to blow. Kemp's people cheered wildly and rushed for the oars. Jensen Brent's forward scout signaled back the startling news to the fleet on Lac Dinashir, who in turn relayed the message to Redwaters. Throughout the temporary sanctuaries that hid the routed people of 10 towns came the same command, "Charge!" The army assembled inside the great gates of Bryn Shander's wall poured out of the courtyard and onto the field. The fleets of Caer Conig and Caer Dinaval on Lac Dinashir and Goodmead and Dugan's Hole in the south lifted their sails to catch the east wind and raced across the lakes. The four fleets assembled on Mare de Walden rode hard, bucking that same wind in their haste to get revenge. In a whirlwind rush of chaos and surprise, the final battle of Icewind Dale had begun. Regis rolled out of the way as the embattled creatures tumbled past again, claws and fangs tearing and ripping in a desperate struggle. Normally, Gwenivar would have had little trouble dispatching the hell dog, but in its weakened state, the cat found itself fighting for its life. The hound's hot breath seared black fur. Its great fangs bit into muscled neck. Regis wanted to help the cat, but he couldn't even get close enough to kick at its foe. Why had Drizzt run off so abruptly? Guinevere felt its neck being crushed by the powerful maw. The cat rolled, its greater weight taking the dog over with it, but the hold of the canine jaws was not broken. Dizziness swept over the cat from lack of air. It began to send its mind back across the plains to its true home, though it lamented having failed its master in his time of need. Then the tower went dark. The startled hellhound relaxed its grip slightly, and Guinevere was quick to seize the opportunity. The cat planted its paws against the dog's ribs and shoved free of the grasp, rolling away into the blackness. The hell dog scanned for its foe, but the panther's powers of stealth were beyond even the considerable awareness of its keen senses. Then the dog saw a second quarry. A single bound took it to Regis. Guinevere was playing a game that it knew better now. The panther was a creature of the night, a predator that struck from the blackness and killed before its prey even sensed its presence. The hell dog crouched for a strike at Regis, then dropped as the panther landed heavily upon its back, claws raking deeply into the rust-colored hide. The dog yelped only once before the killing fangs found its neck. Mirrors cracked and shattered. A sudden hole in the floor swallowed Kessel's throne. Blocks of crystalline rubble began falling all about as the tower shuddered in its death throes. Screams from the harem chamber below told Regis that a similar scene of destruction was common throughout the structure. He was gladdened when he saw Guinevere dispatch the hell dog, but he understood the futility of the cat's heroics. They had nowhere to run, no escape from the death of Kreishald Tirith. Regis called Guinevere to his side. He couldn't see the cat's body in the blackness, but he saw the eyes, intent upon him and circling around, as though the cat was stalking him.
What?
The halfling balked in astonishment, wondering if the stress and the wounds the dog had inflicted upon Guinevere had driven the cat into madness. A chunk of wall crashed right beside him, sending him sprawling to the floor. He saw the cat's eyes rise high into the air. Guinevere had sprung. Dust choked him, and he felt the final collapse of the crystal tower begin. Then came a deeper darkness as the black cat engulfed him. Drizzt felt himself falling. The light was too bright, he couldn't see. He heard nothing, not even the sound of air rushing by. Yet he knew for certain that he was falling. And then the light dimmed in a gray mist, as though he were passing through a cloud. It all seemed so dreamlike, so completely unreal. He couldn't recall how he had gotten into this position. He couldn't recall his own name. Then he dropped into a deep pile of snow and knew that he was not dreaming. He heard the howl of the wind and felt its freezing bite. He tried to stand and get a better idea of his surroundings. And then he heard, far away and below, the screams of the raging battle. He remembered Kreishald Tirith, remembered where he had been. There could be only one answer. He was on top of Kelvin's cairn. The soldiers of Bryn Shander and Easthaven, fighting arm in arm with Cassius and Glen Sather at their head, charged down the sloping hill and drove hard into the confused ranks of goblins. The two spokesmen had a particular goal in mind. They wanted to cut through the ranks of monsters and link up with Brunner's charges. On the wall a few moments before, they had seen the barbarians attempting the same strategy, and they figured that if all three armies could be brought together in flanking support, their slim chances would be greatly improved. The goblins gave way to the assault. In their absolute dismay and surprise at the sudden turn of events, the monsters were unable to organize any semblance of a defensive line. When the four fleets on Mare Dualden landed just north of the ruins of Targos, they encountered the same disorganized and disoriented resistance. Kemp and the other leaders had figured that they could easily gain a foothold on the land, but their main concern was that the large goblin forces occupying Tourmaline would sweep down behind them if they pushed in from the beach and cut off their only escape route. They needn't have worried, though. In the first stages of the battle, the goblins in Tourmaline had indeed rushed out with every intention of supporting their wizard. But then Kreishald Tirith had tumbled down. The goblins were already skeptical, having heard rumors throughout the night that Kessel had dispatched a large force to wipe out the orcs of the Severed Tongue in the conquered city of Bremen. And when they saw the tower, the pinnacle of Kessel's strength, crash down in ruins, they had reconsidered their alternatives, weighing the consequences of the choices before them.
they fled back to the north and the safety of the open plain. Blowing snow added to the heavy veil atop the mountain. Drizzt kept his eyes down, but he could hardly see his own feet as he determinedly placed one in front of the other. He still held the magical scimitar, and it glowed a pale light, as though it approved of the frigid temperatures. The drow's numbing body begged him to start down the mountain, and yet he was moving farther along the high face to one of the adjacent peaks. The wind carried a disturbing sound to his ears, the cackle of insane laughter. And then he saw the blurred form of the wizard, leaning out over the southern precipice, trying to catch a glimpse of what was happening on the battlefield below.
"Kessel!"
Drizzt shouted. He saw the form shift abruptly and knew that the wizard had heard him, even through the howl of the wind.
"In the name of the people of Ten Towns, I demand that you surrender to me. Quickly now, lest this unrelenting breath of winter freeze us where we stand."
Kessel sneered.
"You still do not understand what it is you face, do you?"
he asked in amazement.
"Do you truly believe that you have won this battle?" "How the people below fare, I do not yet know," Drizzt answered. "But you are defeated. Your tower is destroyed, Kessel, and without it you are but a minor trickster."
He continued moving while they talked, and was now only a few feet from the wizard, though his opponent was still a mere black blur in a gray field.
"Do you wish to know how they fare, drow?" Kessel asked. "Then look! Witness the fall of Ten Towns!"
He reached under his cloak and pulled out a shining object, a crystal shard. The clouds seemed to recoil from it. The wind halted within the wide radius of its influence. Drizzt could see its incredible power. The drow felt the blood returning to his numbed hands in the light of the crystal. Then the gray veil was burned away, and the sky before them was clear.
"The tower destroyed?" Kessel marked. "You have broken just one of Kryn Shinabon's countless images. A sack of flour? To defeat the most powerful relic in the world? Look down upon the foolish men who dare to oppose me!"
The battlefield was spread wide before the drow. He could see the white, wind-filled sails of the boats of Kaer Dinaval and Kaer Konig as they neared the western banks of Lac Dinashir. In the south, the fleets of Goodmead and Dugan's Hole had already docked. The sailors met no initial resistance, and even now were forming up for an inland strike. The goblins and orcs that had formed the southern half of Kessel's ring had not witnessed the fall of Kryshal Tirith, though they sensed the loss of power and guidance, and as many of them remained where they were or deserted their comrades and fled, as rushed around Bryn Shander's Hill to join in the battle. Kemp's troops were also ashore,